Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live and on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, July 3rd. Not July 4th, that's tomorrow. July the 3rd, 2022. I'm joined, as always, by a ring announcer, and ring announcing is really just nothing but talking into a microphone and saying names, Chris Cullo. Hello.
It is untrue. Myself and Makita Fuyuki from NOAA disagree with you. He has a great article about it. It's great to be here. It's 4th of July weekend in the United States, so I got my red and blue, and there's little white dots on the blue bow tie. And we had somebody on Twitter. They were very upset because there hasn't been any garden updates. I could tell you that we harvested the strawberries a couple weeks ago, and I think raspberries are soon. But the grapes, I think we're finally going to get grapes this year, and a lot of them. So I'm very excited.
It takes a couple of years sometimes for some of these to bear fruit.
Yeah, 3 to 5 years, yeah. Grapes and cherries. This is year 4 for my cherry trees, and I still don't think I'm going to get cherries, so sad. But we got grapes.
We should have told him about this. We could have put this behind the paywall and monetized it. exciting update.
But yeah, ring announced the show last night, got home at 2 in the morning. I'm here for WrestleNomics Radio. So,
where were you last night?
We were in Binghamton for Excite Wrestling. So.
Excite. How was Excite?
It was fun. It was a memorial show for a wrestler passed away. So there was like 100 people on the card, and I split ring announcing duties with another ring announcer. So, you know, basket raffles, all that. So
this is for Anarchy, right?
Yes. Anarchy Ashaubrey. Yeah.
Yeah. Who made gear too for a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah, Ethan Page being probably the most prolific, I'd say.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I read about that. I was very shocked. So, let's see. We are going to be in Rochester Wednesday. Is that correct?
Yes, Wednesday. This Wednesday. Mm-hmm. We are driving down to Rochester.
All right. And let's see here. You're driving. Is that true?
Yeah. Okay. I don't mind hitting the road. Mm-hmm.
We are paying for our own tickets. Making that very clear. To be fair and balanced here, I might go to MSG Raw later this month. We'll see. No definitive travel plans yet, but we'll be at the Blue Cross Arena. Are we going to wear suits and ties to the Blue Cross Arena?
We have not discussed this. I mean, if you really want to, we can.
No, you can wear whatever you want. So we'll see how that goes. Let's see here. If people want to participate with a super chat or a comment today, how do they do that, Chris Cullo?
Yep, so on the YouTube stream, there's a little dollar sign, and you click that dollar sign with your question. You can put whatever amount you see fit for your question. I think it starts at 99 cents. I thought it was a dollar, but we get 99 cent super chat. So, good.
What are we going to be talking about today?
Well, we got a lot to talk about today here. We're going to discuss the business of Forbidden Door, Logan Paul signing with WWE, analysis of how long matches perform in television ratings. But our lead story is the New York Magazine article that came out about Rita Chatterton's allegations against Vince McMahon, and they were corroborated in this article.
Yeah. Did you watch the Money in the Bank Premium Live event last night?
I did not, as I was doing a wrestling show, so I was working on a wrestling show.
That's right. You hate WWE. Did you watch Blood and Guts Dynamite on Wednesday night?
I did. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's get to this article that came out on Monday from New York Magazine, from Abe Reisman, revisiting the Rita Chatterton allegations.
All right. In 1992, she came forward publicly to accuse Vincent Kennedy McMahon, the iron-willed owner of the WWF, of raping her in the summer of 1986. However, the statute of limitations...
Real quick, who is Rita Chatterton, for those who may not know?
She was WWE's first female referee.
Yes, as it says in the headline right there.
Yeah. I believe she's a member of the International Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, too. I think she went in, like, this past year.
Okay.
However, the statute of limitations for rape had already run out by then, so no charges were brought against McMahon. What's more is the accusation came out while the WWF was mired in a number of unrelated scandals, and it got lost in the shuffle. Since then, her story was whispered about and occasionally cited by wrestling journalists bold enough to risk earning McMahon's ire. The news so disgusted Leonard Nzitari, a former professional wrestler who wrestled as Mario Mancini, that in a conversation with New York Magazine, he did something no wrestler ever has. He corroborated the allegation that McMahon raped Chatterton. "I remember it was like yesterday," says Nzitari. "She was a wreck. She was shaking. She was crying." According to Nzitari, in the summer of 86, he found Chatterton standing alone near the wrestling ring a few hours before a WWF show. "She looks at me and bursts out in tears," Nzitari recalls, "and she grabbed me, and I go, 'Rita, what happened?'" Nzitari doesn't use the word rape while talking about what happened, but he describes something that sounds like the conventional definition of that term. "Was she taken advantage of? Absolutely," Nzitari says. "Was she scared to death? Absolutely. Did she want to do that? Probably not."
And just to interject here, we're reading a number of excerpts. We're not reading the entire article. I highly recommend that people read this if you're interested in learning more about this story. We're skipping over a lot of the really detailed descriptions of the allegations against Vince here, just to give a heads up on that. There will be maybe some strong, disturbing language here. So you can go ahead.
Nzitari said nothing to anyone about what Chatterton told him. "You just keep your mouth shut because it's Vince McMahon." Nzitari said, "What are you going to do, stooge on Vince McMahon? You're going to be blackballed from the wrestling business." "One of the things that sticks with me and always will," she tells me, was after he got done doing his business, he looked at me and said, "Remember when I told you not to mess with any of the wrestlers? Well, you just did." Chatterton says she went to the ladies' room of the diner and cried my heart out. "After that, I washed up, got in the car, went home, and took a 5-hour shower." The next day, she says she called a lawyer whose ads she's seen on local television. "He was willing to take the case, but I knew it would be an uphill battle," she says. "It came down that it was my word against McMahon's because I took a shower and didn't go to the hospital. I was scared," she continues. "He was powerful. It was going to be him over me." She decided not to press charges. Chatterton says she only had two friends in WWF, Nzitari and the late Andre Rusimov, the world-famous wrestler known as Andre the Giant. She says she told both of them allegedly what happened within a couple weeks of it happening. Chatterton's mother died in 1991 and her father died in 1992. Her restraints were gone. "I wanted to tell the world what a scumbag McMahon was," she says. Within a month about her dad's death, she appeared on Geraldo Rivera's show after they approached her. After Chatterton laid out the allegations in brutal detail on Rivera's television program, the WWF reportedly declined to comment. The wrestling firm was embroiled in at least three other major scandals at that time, including allegations of child molestation, sexual harassment, and steroid distribution, and Chatterton's story failed to make any waves. She finally decided to give up on wrestling when Andre the Giant died in early 1993. She and Rusimov had remained close, and she attended a memorial service at Rusimov's estate in rural North Carolina on February 24, 1993. McMahon was also in attendance. Vince walked up to me, Chatterton recalls, and said, "It's nice to meet you." "He knew exactly who I was," she adds. "I said, 'Nice to meet me.' I told him to go fuck himself and walked away." It was their final face-to-face interaction. 9 days later, McMahon and his wife, Linda, filed a lawsuit against Chatterton, Rivera, Rivera's producer, two of Rivera's production partners, and disgruntled former WWF wrestler David Schultz. The suit claimed Chatterton had been part of a conspiracy involving all the defendants, in which they performed numerous torturous acts with the intent of inflicting severe emotional distress upon plaintiffs, including the fabrication of false accusation of rape against plaintiff Vincent McMahon, which was aired on the nation's airwaves. The suit never went anywhere. Filings were made by both sides, but the McMahons abandoned the effort when it came clear that Vince would go to trial on the steroid distribution charges, in which was later acquitted. When the political website Talking Points memo brought up Chatterton's allegations in the context of Linda's 2010 run for Senate in Connecticut, the McMahon's longtime lawyer, Jerry McDivitt, brought the hammer down. Make no mistake, McDivitt told the TPM reporter when she asked for comment, if those false allegations are repeated now and again, Mr. McMahon will pursue all available remedies against those associated with this smear job. TPM ran the post, but didn't pursue the story further. Now, with McMahon facing renewed scrutiny of alleged sexual misconduct, Chatterton is cautiously hopeful that the man might face consequences. He's not going to pay for what he did to me, but she's glad that the hush money allegations are coming to light. Now this girl's come forward, Chatterton says of the paralegal whose friend sent the initial emails to the WWE board, and I'm sure others will come forward because we're not the only two. There's no doubt in my mind about that. Inzitari, too, sees storm clouds ahead for his one-time employer. I'll tell you why I'm hopping on the bandwagon now, the former grappler tells me. There's worse stuff than that.
Okay. So just to catch everybody up, if you don't know, so on June 15th, the Wall Street Journal reported that WWE's board of directors is investigating Vince McMahon for alleged hush money payments that he paid $3 million to a former paralegal who he had a sexual relationship with, that John Laurinaitis had a sexual relationship with. Paralegal was given a raise from $100,000 to $200,000. That would be company money, but the NDA and the hush money payments that former paralegal agreed to, Vince's side at least says that those are that was personal money. The board of directors is investigating additional NDAs. Details about those agreements, who those NDAs involved, is not public. So, in that context, the Rita Chatterton story, which has been public since 1992, is being revisited here in New York Magazine, again by Abe Reisman, who's working on a biography of Vince McMahon. So that's what's happening there. So Rita Chatterton alleges, if it's not clear from the excerpts that we just read, alleges that in 1986 that she was raped in Vince's limousine as they were discussing, as she wanted to discuss, you know, what her future was with the company and whether she could get more bookings and things like that. So that was made public in 1992 amid other scandals, the array of scandals that we sometimes refer to as Titan Gate, 1992. And she went on to Geraldo Rivera's television programs. You can find Rita Chatterton herself telling her story on those programs on YouTube if you search for it. I don't think a lot of wrestling fans have, who might, you know, listen to podcasts and things like that and read, you know, wrestling news and newsletters. I think a lot of people have not seen that stuff because I didn't. So I'm guessing a lot of people haven't. So that's what's happening there. This story came out on Monday morning. Later that night, Monday night, the John Cena tribute episode commemorating John Cena's 20 years in wrestling, in WWE anyway, Vince McMahon comes out and introduces him. They actually just put this is not part of the original YouTube highlights of Raw that they usually upload that night, but they just uploaded, I believe on Friday, they uploaded the video of Vince introducing John Cena. So he's on TV again. So he's been on TV Friday, the day that Vince stepped down as CEO and chairman and is still running the creative side. But he stepped down as CEO and chairman. Stephanie is officially in his role as interim CEO and chairwoman. By the way, I'm not sure. I mean, David Vixen Span has raised the point that it's What were Vince's capacities as CEO, other than head of creative, that he is actually stepping aside from? Not clear. Anyway, Vince went on TV on Friday for SmackDown, the 17th. Vince went on TV on Monday, unadvertised, the following Monday, which would be, what, the 20th. And now on TV again, June 27th. Just to show that, you know, everything is this would be my analysis, right? Everything is normal. Nothing is not normal. Everything is normal. I'm here. I'm still here. And everything is okay. Last night, Money in the Bank, which you did not watch, Chris Cole.
Nope.
I watched it on mute. Because there's only so much my senses can handle. There's only so much premium live event that I can take in at once. At the event, at MGM Grand Arena, this is coming from Aaron Oster on Twitter, who shares a photo from the merchandise stand. They're selling Vince McMahon shirts at the merchandise stand in Las Vegas. And after the event is over with, they walk down the street to T-Mobile Arena, where UFC is happening, and UFC puts them on the screen. Vince, Stephanie, Paul Levesque, and Pat McAfee in a neck brace selling his attack from Baron Corbin. So everything is normal. It's really what Vince is best at, is denying reality. And I think back to, like, you know, I guess it's kind of coincidental that in 1992 is when I start to have a lot of memories of wrestling. I'm sure I was watching it for a couple of years before then, but in 1992, and I was not aware of any of the 1992 scandal news at the time. But I remember watching a lot of wrestling at that time and sort of starting to realize that there were, you know, people would leave or come and go, and nothing would be acknowledged. And of course, you got the underlying fact of wrestling being sort of kayfabed and pretending to be a real sport. In a lot of ways, this is what Vince is very well practiced at, is living with this elephant in the room and not paying any attention. No, there's no elephant in this room. Everything's fine. And when you look at some of these economic indicators, things aren't that bad. The stock price, which after the Wall Street Journal story broke on June 15th, so this is just, so close the market, market closes, story's not broken yet, market closes, story comes out, W stock price is at $67, $67 per share. It falls for a number of days in a row. It underperforms the indexes, so this is not just a macro effect. But since in this past week, the stock has climbed, including some days where it's outperformed the indexes. So the stock price is back to $62.50, still off of its pre-Wall Street Journal story price, but it did recover some of its value. So it's not as if investors are continuing to see a damaging crisis here, even though there are upwards of seven class action lawsuit press releases having been sent out, saying they're investigating the situation and looking to make a class action complaint. Raw this Monday, again, with the John Cena episode celebrating his career. John Cena hasn't been on Raw since at least SummerSlam, right? Raw was not just number one on cable this week, not just number one if you average all 3 hours together, but each hour, even the less viewed third hour, these were the three most watched telecasts on all of television on Monday, at least in the demo. Not in total viewership, but in the demo, which is what Showbuzz ranks them by, and which is what advertisers buy advertising slots against. There wasn't super strong competition. To be fair, the next most watched telecast was Celebrity Family Feud on ABC, but Raw was the leader across all of television on Monday for the return of John Cena. Raw and SmackDown continue to do pretty well in ratings. NXT sort of went back to normal here, but not doing that badly relative to what it's been doing lately. And we've got the prelim rating for SmackDown that came out Saturday morning, showing what SmackDown had done the night before, and it looks to have done basically equal. Again, we'll get the, you know, the final on Monday as always, but looks to have done basically equal to what it did the week before. So not what the enormous advertised appearance of Vince did, which was about 2.4 million viewers. But over 2.2 million viewers, it looks like it's going to be finalized as. We'll see on Monday. So ratings strong. Stock fell at first, but stock recovering some of that value that it lost since then. Despite the Wall Street Journal report, despite the New York Magazine story, interview with Rita Chatterton and Mario Mancini. By the way, one of the big takeaways of the New York Magazine article is that we've got Mario Mancini, who's a former jobber wrestler, a friend of Rita Chatterton, saying that at the time, in 1986, the following day, Rita Chatterton tells him the story of what happened in the limo with Vince. She says she told Andre the Giant too. David Bixen's fan has pointed out that, by the way, Bix and John Pollock and Wei Ting on Post Wrestling, I believe on Monday, their daily news show on Monday, had a great conversation with a lot of insight about this story, that people should check out if they haven't already. Rita Chatterton says she told Andre. The Observer says, at the time that, you know, they had heard that, somebody who's a major name in the industry, had told the Observer, that is Dave, that, you know, something had happened. So not clear if Dave was talking to Andre the Giant, or what was happening there, but there's that. Will there be more mainstream coverage of this? Maybe, here that Real Sports with Brian Gumbel is reaching out to people. So maybe that would happen if that does happen. So Real Sports with Brian Gumbel on HBO is a monthly program. They would be due for a new episode late in this month. So maybe that will happen. Not saying that they're definitely going to do a story. I did reach out to them to confirm whether or not they were going to do a story. I didn't hear back, but, that might be the next thing, but still that's a few weeks away. It's not as if this is still getting tons of media coverage. The interview, the revisiting of the Rhea Chatterton allegations didn't get a ton of mainstream news coverage. Business Insider covered it. Maybe a couple of other publications, the wrestling media, after some delay, in many cases, did cover it. So that's what's happening there. Anything else to add here, Phil?
No, I just, you know, I feel like we will see at least some more media coverage as time goes on, but we're seeing nothing from the WWE. And then they said they're not going to acknowledge, well, the hush money stuff until the investigation's over, and that this won't be acknowledged at all by them. As you said, Vince McMahon goes to the, if you don't acknowledge it, it goes away theory. You know, that's how he's been for a lot of controversies and all that. So,
I mean, that's what they did after the Jamal Khashoggi murder. There's stuff here about Dave Schultz and Mario Mancini did an interview with, I believe it's Cheap Heat is the name of the podcast. This is not the Sam Roberts Cheap Heat, but he did an interview, which people can find on YouTube also, just after this interview came out in New York Magazine, saying things like Dave Schultz knows more, but Dave Schultz wants to be paid. I don't know if Dave Schultz is going to end up being the most credible person to add to the story, but the points that Rita Chatterton makes in her interview here and that Mario Mancini makes in his interview here is that they believe there's more. They believe that there, and that would reflect what is in the Wall Street Journal article. They're investigating one NDA that we know of with a certain paralegal who's no longer with the company as of January 2022. They're also investigating additional NDAs with people who are not named, at least yet. Or not that the former paralegal is named either, but we don't know who that involves, whether it involves other former WWE employees or other former WWE talent. But it wouldn't surprise me if there are a lot more allegations and stories of, at a minimum, inappropriate relationships between Vince and people working at WWE.
All right.
Yes.
We will move on to Forbidden Door business. And we'll get into the pay-per-view buys, which you reported. Forbidden Door generated about 127,000 worldwide pay-per-view buys across digital and traditional distributors, according to multiple people at AEW and New Japan who are familiar with the sales. Just over 7,000 of those sales happen on New Japan's streaming service a New Japan Pro Wrestling World. After splitting a pay-per-view revenues with various carriers, net revenue for the event will come about to $4.4 million, not including any sales from theater viewing or sponsors like DraftKings.
Mm-hmm. So we could compare this to other pay-per-views that AEW has done. I don't know, by the way, if this is, you know, this is advertised as a joint show between AEW and New Japan. By all indications, you know, everything about this show looked like an AEW show in terms of, I don't know, the production, the venue that they've, which is a venue that AEW has ran before, the pay-per-view platforms, with the exception of New Japan World, were all platforms, as far as I know, that had distributed AEW pay-per-view before. So I don't know if there's some sort of agreement in terms of, did New Japan and All Elite Wrestling share pay-per-view revenue, for example, here? Did New Japan simply get a licensing fee? Can't confirm what exactly the story was here. So keeping that in mind, there was at least one extra platform for pay-per-view buys, which was New Japan World, I'm told. That platform sold 7,000, which, you know, brings 120,000 to 127,000 pay-per-view buys. Expectations for this going in. You made a prediction for Skull on this very program. How many pay-per-view buys this show would do?
Meanwhile, I can't remember if I said 130, 135, but I was close. Either way.
You've got the naysayers out there saying that this, I declined to make a prediction because I was, you know, probably like there's a chance that I would end up reporting it. So I would have gone much lower than where you went. I guess you were a little high, and I should say that this is not a final number, and the traditional carriers will take months to finalize, but it's probably going to end up somewhere in here. Nobody will ever tell us the real actual sales numbers because I don't think carriers want that information shared. But I do believe these numbers, which we could put on the screen here, the buy numbers, I do believe these numbers are accurate. Obviously, we're rounding, if nothing else, to the nearest 1,000 or the nearest 5,000 or something like that. But yeah.
I mean, for me, I knew it was going to, in my opinion, I knew it was going to do less numbers than Double or Nothing. And I think we kind of saw that with the ratings, right? Like, I mean, you know, there is a lot of American fans that do enjoy the New Japan Pro Wrestling product, but I don't think the way this was, that demand isn't as much as maybe it was expected. I mean, look at the TV ratings all through the month of June, and we'll look at that obviously in full detail when we do the who's the draw this month for the June numbers. But it just not that predicted maybe knew there was going to be a drop. Did I think it was going to be a super low drop, like 100,000? No, but I mean, just looking at TV ratings, you knew there was going to be some type of drop. Because look at the TV ratings. They're done with the New Japan angle, Blood and Guts. They're back to over a million.
So what you're saying is, what about the casual fan? The casual fan doesn't care about New Japan Pro Wrestling. That's what you're saying, right?
I mean, if you want to say that in very, very simple terms, I think the casual fan doesn't know a lot about New Japan Pro Wrestling. And they just, being in the middle of summer, they weren't going to try to figure out.
I think a major factor here are the injuries and the lack of CM Punk. What does this do if you do have CM Punk versus Hiroshi Tanahashi on top? It does better. If you got Brian Danielson versus maybe Zack Sabre, I don't know if that makes a huge difference, but that's something. It is only a month removed from the previous pay-per-view when, up to this point, AEW has done nothing but, you know, 3 months in between pay-per-views. So it's more volume. Then again, pay-per-view is proven to be a pretty inelastic product. What does that mean? At least when it comes to price, it doesn't really matter what you charge for it. It matters, but there's a lot of leeway. You can raise the price, you can lower the price, and the sales don't strongly move to the movement of the price. We've learned that from the In Your House history. We've learned that from the W Network. You can cut the price into 1/6, and you might double sales, but it's not going to 6 times the sales, you know? You can increase the price of pay-per-view from $15 to $20 to $30 to $35 to $50, and it's not going to have a huge bearing on the sales that you can achieve. This pay-per-view was the same price as AEW pay-per-views, whether you know, from market to market. It was $50 in the U.S. It was $20 on Fight internationally. Its price didn't change, but the volume of the product was more frequent, we could say, right? Because this was not a quarterly pay-per-view. This was a pay-per-view that was only 1 month removed from the last pay-per-view, but still did comparably, might be a stretch, but did pretty close to what pay-per-views usually do for AEW, despite the weakened card. And I think some earned criticism about the build. This would be the least bought AEW pay-per-view since Double or Nothing 2021, which is pre-full capacity live events. I believe there were maybe thousands of people in attendance for Double or Nothing 2021. We'd have to look that up. But because they did that, that's one of the ones that they did in Daly's Place where it's outdoors.
In Jacksonville,
So they put more people in there. But since CM Punk has been here in AEW, pay-per-views have done no lower than, until this one, which he wasn't on, 145 for Full Gear 2021. Anyway.
Now, if they do this again next year, it will probably be an increase because, like you said, the CM Punk you would think would be part of that show, Bryan Danielson, maybe Kenny Omega. So,
right, true. It's hard to imagine a weaker card than this one for this pool of talent. Like you said, no CM Punk, no Bryan Danielson, no Kenny Omega, all due to injury. No Tomohiro Ishii, no Big Tom. I mean, how can you expect to draw when you don't have Tomohiro Ishii on the card?
I was going to ask you, is Naito hurt as well?
No, he was at a baseball game.
Okay, I was going to be there. Because he's like the one when I was really like, why is he not on this? If he's not hurt, like,
yeah, he was the biggest name probably that was not on this show. We'll see what happens next year. This exceeded my expectations and the expectations of a lot of people. I know there's there's some betting site now that's based, I think, in the UK that was taking bets on what this pay-per-view would do, according to our reports. I believe 135 was the over-under, but over 35 was definitely the underdog. So there you have it. No, I did not bet on this. And so there's that. As far as all the money combined here, I know Tony Khan tweeted on, I believe it was Tuesday, that, you know, this event grossed more than $1 million on pay-per-view. That's before the pay-per-view providers take away their share. More than $1 million as a live gate. WrestleTix reporting 1.1 million. I believe The Observer probably reporting 1.1 million for a live gate. That would be consistent with what I could estimate based on what WrestleTix reported for tickets distributed times 95%. Assume 5% of those tickets distributed are comps. And give it an average ticket price. Did I put it in here? Give it an average ticket price of about $75. You get to 1.1 million when you round. Then we assume $15 per capita in terms of any merch, that gives us another $200,000 or so. And based on all these assumptions that I'm not going to read in audio, but we get to 4.4 million to AEW and or New Japan, depending on how they made this business arrangement. How does that compare? That would be what have we got here? All Out remains the most lucrative AEW pay-per-view ever, right? All Out, the return of CM Punk to the ring. 5.6 million is my estimate. These are estimates. 5.6 million. The second most lucrative event is Double or Nothing 2022, 5.1 million. Then Revolution of this year, 4.7 million. So this Forbidden Door at 4.4 million would beat out Full Gear, mainly driven by the gate. Less pay-per-view revenue, but Full Gear, I'm estimating the gate was something like $650,000. This one in United Center, higher attendance, perhaps higher ticket prices. That drives Forbidden Door above Full Gear 2021. I believe that was in Minnesota. Is that correct?
If I remember, yeah. We have a super chat from Tim B. Thank you, Tim. Any chance we can start tracking the pay-per-view conversion rate for shows compared to the four-week TV ratings? A new WrestleNomics metric? Question.
Well, the thing is, TV ratings are if all other things are equal, I expect linear TV ratings, unless Nielsen, I guess, you know, if someday we've all got access to live television through some sort of streaming product, and I guess to some extent we do, but if that becomes more complete and ubiquitous, and that offsets the deterioration of MVPD subs, which we'll get into later. So what I'm trying to say here is TV ratings are, if all other things are equal, if your popularity is equal, your star power is equal, everything else is equal, TV ratings I would expect to decline slightly over time from year to year by at least a few percent each year. So that we could calculate that. I don't know if that would not be misleading though. Because, you know, the TV viewership over time is probably going to be lower. So that conversion rate is going to end up being higher. And we're going to tell probably a slightly more positive story than I would think the reality is. Maybe there's some way to isolate it, though. What I have been finding is that, and I did not go back and check this, but I have been finding that and I think we talked about this several weeks ago, that the web search for the string, if you could do Google Trends, and you look at the web search for the string, AEW space PPV, and you look at the 2 days prior to a AEW pay-per-view date, if you start at like Double or Nothing 2021 or 2020, I think it is, you do see some correlation between what we end up reporting for buys and what we end up seeing in the 2 days prior to the date for that AEW PPV web search term, for what that's worth. Reception. Did you watch this pay-per-view?
I've seen some of it, but I have not even got a chance of going around watching it yet.
Take us through the card.
I've seen some clips and stuff.
Starting with the buy-in. So this, according to Cage Match, so looking at the voters in Cage Match, so for example, this might be a little bit more by now, but 380 Cage Matchers, inmates at thecagematch.net, they voted on this. This is, think of this as Rotten Tomatoes or something like that. The critical reception for this event, 8 out of 10, a 9.27. Compared to all other AEW pay-per-views, this would be the second most well-received. The second most well-received behind All Out 2021, which was also the most lucrative pay-per-view that AEW has ever done. So this was very well-received. Some people, maybe including myself, not that excited about it going in because of all the changes to the card and all the injuries that happened in the build. But this was very well received, at least by the voters, 380 of them on Cage Match. So there's that. Now, another not quite pay-per-view, although it probably was still distributed on pay-per-view, but a premium live event, live on Peacock in the W Network. By the way, in Australia, you could watch this on linear television. I believe their TV partner in Australia, Foxtel, put it on free television for some reason. Money in the Bank, of course, had to move from Allegiant Stadium in Nick Khan's hometown of Las Vegas after ticket sales. I do believe, so this is basically what I'm not 100% positive on this, but this is my belief, is that the stadium probably sold more tickets than they ended up being, than they would have been able to fit in this venue. Yeah. So let's see what they put in here. Tickets distributed, according to WrestleTix, for Money in the Bank was over 12,000. 12,076. I wouldn't be surprised if at Allegiant Stadium they sold more than 12,000, or more than maybe even 13,000, whatever the absolute maximum capacity would be for their configuration in MGM Grand Arena. But it wasn't, the sales weren't high enough to justify all the expenses that would come along with doing the event at that stadium, and maybe with some other budgeting that were embedded in that plan, including the talent, because we saw Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns initially advertised for this event, and obviously they did not appear on this event. So they moved this, as everyone is wont to say, to the more intimate confines of MGM Grand Arena for Money in the Bank. So far, and this is only with 33 votes, and actually I have 69 votes over here. So this is from last night, but there's up to 70 votes now. We're showing on the screen a 6.15 rating for the reception on Cage Match. It is actually up to 6.27. Not a huge difference, but a difference. That would put it, I don't know, on par with WrestleMania Sunday. This is, I would say that's about average for a WWE pay-per-view premium live event. So that's the reception for Money in the Bank. There we go. And have you heard?
Yeah, Logan Paul has signed with WWE.
Tell us what Ariel Helwani tweeted about this signing.
Yep, so he had two tweets. One tweet was Logan Paul had signed a deal with WWE. He just announced on Twitter, per sources, it's a multi-year deal to compete at multiple events per year. No return date set, but could be next month at SummerSlam. Miz would make a lot of sense. Now, additional details per the sources on the second tweet. Deal includes an undisclosed number of premium live events across 2022 and 2023. He'll likely, I'm told, have his first big appearance at SummerSlam, but could be on TV before that. He signed his deal yesterday, and that was out on June 30th, that tweet.
Okay. So, is Logan Paul huge? Did you know who Logan Paul was before he appeared on WrestleMania this year?
Yes.
How did you know him?
I knew him through really kind of the boxing appearances. And you know, their YouTube stars and all that. Like, I always heard people talk about them. They come up on social media feeds, but what I really started paying attention was the boxing stuff with Triller that him and his brother were doing.
Okay. So hold up. There's a brother named Jake Paul.
Yes.
Okay. Isn't Jake Paul the one who's like boxing? Who's the greatest boxer of our time who fought Conor McGregor? Mayweather. Mayweather, right? Mayweather just toyed with him for like 9 rounds or something, right?
Yes.
So there's Jake Paul too, but Logan Paul has done boxing also through Triller?
Yes. He is 0-1-2 in his fights. He had a split decision against KSI, and so a draw and a loss to KSI. Oh, let's see here. KSI.
I know the answer to all these questions. I'm just seeing if you do.
Yeah. Out of UK, I don't really know much about KSI. I feel like I do if I like really see it. But yeah, KSI and Logan Paul. But he looks like he's the one that fought Floyd Mayweather, not Jake.
Really?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
So, but this is now what they are quite known for. But before the boxing stuff, they were known for being YouTubers?
Yes.
What kind of YouTube content did they make?
It was like fights, wasn't it? Like I said, I didn't really become super familiar with them. I mean, I heard of them, but I didn't become familiar until they actually showed up in boxing, in the boxing world. And you start hearing about all these boxing fights.
So this sounds familiar. So Logan Paul was involved in some controversy about a video that he did.
That was in a suicide forest in Japan, right?
Yes.
I think,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, he was on WrestleMania, obviously, in a tag match, right?
Yes. Yes, it was him and The Miz versus The Mysterios, if I remember.
Okay. And then, like, Miz turned on him afterward, right?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. You're supposed to take notes about this.
Yeah. He wore a very rare Charizard card to the ring, too.
But it struck me, you know, sort of vaguely watching WrestleMania this year, which I did, even though we remember a few details from it. Logan Paul, Pat McAfee, Johnny Knoxville. This was a very WrestleMania 11-ish WrestleMania this year. By that, I mean it was loaded with celebrities. And it sort of started to occur to me that, you know, maybe the future of this company and really a point of differentiation from typical wrestling and blood and guts things like AEW, coupled with WWE's Vince McMahon-driven inability to cultivate traditional wrestling stars, that WWE over time, especially if Vince McMahon continues to be that of creative for a number of years to come, then maybe WWE continues to become this presentation, especially during their premium live events, especially on their on the highest level like WrestleMania, continues to become more and more of this celebrity deathmatch type product, you know, live action. Everybody's remember Celebrity Deathmatch, right? The claymation MTV thing from the, you know, the late 90s. Why develop stars when you can just buy them, you know? So maybe that's what happens. And that's an answer to WWE's inability to cultivate stars. I know Theory was in some ways elevated last night. Liv Morgan, I guess. Are those stars that are going to be major stars for WWE for years to come? I don't know. WWE, through attrition, has established Roman Reigns as a big star. Brock Lesnar is, you know, had to go to UFC and come back, but he's a real big star. Becky Lynch has been elevated. That's true. And they've pulled in Ronda Rousey. There's another example, right? Somebody, all of these stars who are not on the roster full time. And maybe Ronda is, and I know she went away to have a child and all those things, but you know, Brock is not full time. Now Roman Reigns is not full time. It's a very strange situation.
I'm wondering if we're gonna get any reports that does this Rob Gronkowski deal reinitiate now that he has officially retired from the NFL again.
I did think about that when I saw that he retired again. But there's no Mojo Rawley with the company now. So
Or they just re-sign him.
Sure. So anyway, how big of a star is Logan Paul relative to some of WWE's other stars? If Google Trends is any indication, which it may or may not be, but I believe Google Trends is a good suggestion. A good place to start. So what I've got here on the screen is the last 12 months of Google web search, and I put Logan Paul on the chart, and I put the top four full-time WWE wrestlers, well, full-time, the top four who actually have matches during a given year. This would exclude retired wrestlers like Hulk Hogan, The Rock, and John Cena. So number one is Roman Reigns. Number two is Brock Lesnar. Number three is Ronda Rousey. Number four lately is Cody Rhodes. Put Logan Paul on the chart with those four, and you get he's not, over the last 12 months with all the stuff that he does, he's not quite as high as Roman Reigns. Okay, acknowledge him. Roman Reigns is a big star, at least when it comes to how much people search about these personalities. But he is edging out Brock Lesnar, so he would be right in between Lesnar and Reigns. Essentially, that number two for web search, in terms of which reflects, if I believe nothing else we can say, it reflects name recognition, it reflects mind share. How much are people thinking about this person? And I think that's worth something in terms of understanding somebody's star power. This is not somebody who's going to go to house shows, I would think. It's not somebody. I don't know how many times he's going to wrestle on Raw, but what did Ariel Helwani say? He's going to be on premium live events for multiple years. So we'll see what happens there.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Blood and guts and things of that nature. You watched this event on Dynamite?
Yes. I did watch Blood and Guts. I mean, it was something I was kind of hyped up for hearing the addition of Claudio Castagnoli. So always was a fan of Claudio's work.
Mm-hmm. So I believe JR did call Cesaro at least one time during this broadcast.
Yeah, he also called Ruby a Soho Ruby Riot.
Wonderful. So anyway, this match was too long, right? Not that good. Too long.
I don't know. Being an old War Games fan, it was fine. You know, those matches are supposed to be long.
They're so my mom did watch this. Casual fan. My mom because she knows, you know, Daniel Garcia is from Buffalo, and you know he trained in Buffalo. So she watched. She said she watched about up to the 9:45 mark, and then had to turn it off because it was just too long. So there, I did watch the whole thing, and so millions of people must have also turned it off, right? We'll investigate this. So here what we're going to look at here is not just Blood and Guts. We will look at Blood and Guts, and we will look at which was a very long match. How long was Blood and Guts match time? 46 minutes, 45 seconds. Occupied the entire second hour of Dynamite this past Wednesday. So with entrances and post-match stuff, the entire hour. I believe there's a video intro that even started maybe a little bit before that second hour. But we have here, I believe, 10 matches from WWE and AEW that aired on weekly television. All of these matches within the last year and over 25 minutes long in match time, according to Cage Match. So we have a 10-man tag from Dynamite in July of last year. We have a tag team Casino Battle Royal, a three-way tag match from Raw with RK-Bro winning the tag titles. We have a Gauntlet NXT tag match from this past April. We have the Adam Page and Bryan Danielson 30-minute match, which was the rematch of their hour draw. The Bryan Danielson Kenny Omega 30-minute match from September. MJF and CM Punk 38-minute match from February. A Gauntlet Women's match from Raw and one of the preemptions on Sci-Fi from February. Blood and Guts from this past Wednesday, and the 60-minute Adam Page Bryan Danielson match from December on Dynamite. So anyway, we'll go through this one by one, sort of who's a draw style, and we'll ask ourselves the question: Do these long matches help viewership, or do people kind of get tired of it and think, you know, this is going on too long, and I'm going to tune out of this? So we'll see what happens. We'll have Blood and Guts as one data point, and we will look at other data points to sort of... I would like to think about here is, are good long matches good for TV? Should Tony Khan and Vince McMahon think about doing more of them or fewer of them? So let's look first and foremost at this past Wednesday's quarter hours. And what we see, second hour of Dynamite showing, is that this first quarter at the top of the hour, which in the last four weeks of Dynamite usually doesn't move much at all. Usually, what we've got here for people watching on YouTube, we've got here lined up next to the quarter to quarter movement is what the trend is, what the last 4 weeks did on a median basis, what we can expect. And this grew the audience in the first quarter of the second hour tremendously. Up 16% in the demo, up 8% in total viewership. Whereas again, that quarter is usually flat. Following quarter usually drops a little. It grew a little. The next quarter usually drops a few percent more. It was stable in total viewership. It was down a normal amount in the demo. And then the final quarter for Dynamite, with the culmination, the finish, and the post-match of Blood and Guts, flat when it's usually flat, up in the demo when it's usually essentially flat. So I would say, you know, and as I tweeted, on Wednesday night, as the show was happening, before the match started, I think, that, you know, long matches usually help viewership. I should be transparent with my belief coming into this analysis. The long matches usually help viewership. And what's been happening lately on Dynamite is Dynamite has been, you know, they have the Big Bang Theory. It helps them start out strong. But even after the Big Bang Theory wears off, after 15, 30 minutes or so, they're still struggling to hold on to viewers throughout the second hour. You know, if we look at that trend line that I draw, I don't have ready, but if we look at that trend line that I draw on the quarter hour charts that people may be familiar with, what we've been seeing a lot lately is that trend line going negative in the second hour. That is not what happened this week. This bucked the trend. So I would say, if you didn't like this match being long, that's your personal taste, but I think this did well for the ratings. I think that's the answer to Blood and Guts. Any retorts there, Cole?
No, I mean, you can see, I mean, just even the entrance is doing the increase that they did. Like, you can see
that quarter had entrances, then it had an ad break, and then it had more entrances. And then, but the match did start in the first 15 minutes of the 9 o'clock hour.
Yeah.
So we'll move on to Raw on Valentine's Day this year with the gauntlet match between, God, who's in this? Rhea Ripley, Nikki Ash, Liv Morgan, Doudrop, and Bianca Belair. So this is a gauntlet match. Maybe this is not like to like, because a gauntlet match is a series of singles matches, sort of in a relay, right? You could argue that this is not really the same as thinking about one match being one long match. This is sort of a relay of individual matches, perhaps. Nonetheless, I think there's still this sort of emotional psychological effect with the audience in that we want to see the culmination of this. Who's going to come out the winner at the end? So anyway, what we had here in this women's gauntlet match is this stretch from the 9 o'clock hour to the 10 o'clock hour. So it stretched across the entire hour? Wow. What was the match time?
Yeah.
Here it is. 44 minutes. So yes, this did stretch across the entire hour. When you probably included entrances and maybe post-match and the ad break at the end afterward. So what this did was, let's see, it started up 2%, but that's normal, and about normal in a demo too. Dropped worse in the second quarter of it, a little bit more than normal, but even in the demo. Outperformed in this Q7, which is the third quarter of this match in total viewership. Outperformed in the demo, but then underperformed. And we do have two ad breaks in here in this final quarter, which may be what's driving this underperforming of the trend of, you know, -9% versus -2%. So this is a case where I would like to have the minute by minute numbers and then just factor out all of those ad break minutes and see what this really did. But this, at least, I would argue, despite this last quarter appearing to be negative, while usually it's not as negative, I would argue that that's probably driven by the ad breaks, two ad breaks in one quarter, as opposed to, and they did get to use, so this was on Sci-Fi. Usually on when Raw is on USA Network, they do not do picture-in-picture ads. They did when they were preempted to Sci-Fi. This is during the Winter Olympics time. If nothing else, I think this is not a negative story. It's not like this long match killed the viewership, would be my reading of this, despite that bad-looking quarter. But it had two ad breaks in it. So anyway, we go on to Dynamite on February 2nd with the long MJF versus CM Punk main event, which, you know, did in the range of 900,000 viewers, in the range of 450,000 viewers in the demo. First quarter of it underperformed a little bit. Second quarter of it overperformed. And last quarter of it performed solidly. So I would call that, you know, not detrimental, not a negative story. When we're dealing with, you know, a few points of percent difference, not a huge story to me in this first quarter. But then you have this other one that overperformed significantly, I would say, where -5 was the norm coming in, +4. And then it basically performs on par for the last quarter. So I would say that's positive, slightly. Then January 5th. So the January 5th example will be tough because this is the first ever Dynamite on TBS. This is the first ever episode that had Big Bang Theory lead in. So the trailing 4 weeks are four trailing weeks on TNT. So what we see here actually is a huge tune out in... So this is for the 30-minute. This is for the rematch, right? So this is the one that goes about 30 minutes. And we see way under performance in Q2. As probably a lot of Big Bang Theory lead-in folks tune out. And then we see stronger retention and actually some growth in the last quarter of this match. I guess I would say that is inconclusive. But if we looked at... What we really would want to look at here is, you know, what did the following quarters, what did the following episodes do in terms of a trend? Anyway, I would say it's inconclusive, not to get bogged down here in audio. And then the tag team gauntlet match from NXT, which, along with a lot of stuff, dropped tremendously in Q7 here with a -12%, but a +3 versus a +1 in the demo. And then we have this ad break here. So the second quarter of this, which was also the only quarter that we're looking at here that is a full 15 minutes and is in the entirety of the Gauntlet match, which overperformed strongly in the demo, in the overrun versus the overrun, usually doing a 10%, did a 19% here. So I would say that's a mostly positive story for that NXT Tag Team Gauntlet match, where Pretty Deadly comes out on top as the new NXT Tag Team Champions. And then the three-way triple threat. The triple threat match for the tag titles, where RK-Bro end up winning the tag titles, I believe, from Alpha Academy. Also, Seth Rollins and Kevin Owens, who were the third team in this match. This doesn't really grow in Q2, whereas it usually grows. This grows more than normal in the Q3, which is the second quarter of the match. And then it grows really strongly, whereas it's usually flat for this Q4, which is the culmination of the match. So I would say that's a positive story. Getting over 2 million viewers on March 7th, momentarily, at a time when they're probably not hitting 2 million very often, for what psychologically that's worth. But a positive story, I would say. And then, is this the last one? No. Jesus. Oh, there's quite a few more.
Yeah, there is.
And then, the hour-long match between Danielson and Adam Page from December 15th. This is the TNT. This is the TNT era. So excuse me for having this TBS here. I could program that out. Anyway, up 2% versus, you know, usually down. Decline, but not as badly as usual. Grew tremendously, whereas it's usually flat, and then flat when it's usually almost flat. So I'd say that's a very positive story for that 1 hour match. More 1 hour matches is what I would argue for here. Anyway. Be more serious in a moment. And then September 22nd with the Omega and Danielson match. Again, this is the TBS era. This is incorrect at the top here. 1.2 million viewers. Remember September? Jesus.
Yep.
That was a different time.
Do you remember the 22nd of September?
Is that a song? I mean...
Well, the 21st of November, yeah.
With the benefit of hindsight... And getting away from this in the present moment where we're analyzing the week to week nonsense of ratings, but to look back, this is startling to see this. Knowing what Dynamite is doing now, it really emphasizes to me how hot that period was in September, just after the debut of, you know, it's more than a month after now, but just after the debut of CM Punk, the arrival of Bryan Danielson. And this match was advertised, and look at this. This hit 1.3 million viewers. Anyway, this 30-minute draw, right?
And this is Arthur Ashe, right?
I believe that's correct, yes.
This was the Arthur Ashe Stadium show, yeah.
So outperformed in that Q2 and about on par in the following. So I would say positive story there. July 28th, 2021. A 10-man tag that opened the show. Again, all these matches over 25 minutes grew or held steady. So that's a positive quarter there. And then outperformed in the third quarter of the match. So I would say that's definitely a positive story. There you have it. I don't know if you're taking notes in your composition book there, Golo, but...
I mean, overall, long matches are good for television. They don't really kill the ratings. If anything, they hold it, but they grow it a lot too.
Should there be more long matches in wrestling? I remember back in the day, I mean, heck, if you would listen to the right podcast, it's still happening, right? Nobody wants to see wrestling on wrestling shows. That's obvious. That's everyone agrees about that, right? People tune in to U.S. pro wrestling shows because they want to see the drama, the storyline, the soap opera. They want to see all the talking segments and all the promos. That's what people want. If you look back to the Attitude Era, it was nothing but garbage wrestling and promos, and that's what made it popular, and that's what brought in the casual fan, the mainstream people, and all the people who never would watch wrestling anyway. They don't want to see long wrestling matches because people tune out of that, right? So what's happening here?
I mean... It's the opposite. Like I think the person that truly likes pro wrestling is the person that's still tuning in.
So wait a minute. You're saying
I think the one that just wants to see promos and characters and
are you saying that when people tune into a program that has the word wrestling in it, or at least has an initialism like WWE that has the word wrestling in it, that they actually might want to see professional wrestling matches between excellent wrestlers.
It's a foreign concept. I get it. But yes.
Everything that I've learned from the history of U.S. professional wrestling the last 20 years, maybe not so much from actually observing the content and the economic output of that content, but at least from listening to the people who have had positions of power in wrestling over the last 20 years, 25-ish, 30 maybe, listening to those people who have been there, they've been there. Listening to those people, this makes no sense. Anyway, moving on. Big Ten. Tell me about the Big Ten.
So this past week, it was announced that USC and UCLA are going to join the Big Ten Conference in 2024. This is big for multiple reasons. First off, obviously, the landscape of college sports and the aspect of what happens now to the Pac-12.
Now the Big Ten has to rename itself the Big 12, right?
Nope. They've been more than 10. So I was talking to you about this week. It means absolutely nothing. geography doesn't matter anymore. Number of teams in the conference don't matter anymore.
Does the Pac-12 have 12 teams?
I believe so, yes. Well, now they have 10. Okay. And then they used to be the Pac-10. There's stories about who they're going to add or whatever, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about TV rights, right? Because that's how it constitutes the WrestleNomics business. So the Big Ten TV rights deal is up next year. So obviously this is the negotiation year, okay? They currently air their games between ESPN and Fox, but Fox also owns 61% of the Big Ten network, which shows all the second-tier sports and then maybe the second-tier football and basketball games, okay? But okay. Just between the premier football games, ESPN and Fox currently split those, and they pay $430 million a year combined for those TV rights. Before the addition of USC and UCLA, as Bloomberg reports, it was projected that they were going to top $1 billion a year. And that is before you add two colleges.
Between Fox and ESPN together.
Well, no, whoever gets the rights.
So there's only going to be one rights holder?
Yeah, so of these premier games. So it could be a split thing, but what they have reported here is ESPN, CBS, Comcast, NBC, Amazon, Apple have expressed interest in bidding on the remaining games, according to the Sports Channel. So this must be from what Fox doesn't have, which reported the conference's total haul for the media rights will top $1 billion a year, even before the two Los Angeles universities were added in. And that's from Jerry Smith's article that was out on the 1st from Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. And that's before adding two colleges in the second largest media market in the United States. So this is going to be historic, I think, this rights deal. It will be the largest in college football, I think.
Is this the big league? Are these all the big names? Is there another conference that's bigger?
Well, Southeastern Conference, the SEC, which, SEC. Much like how the Big Ten has their own network, where Fox owns a controlling interest, ESPN owns a controlling interest in the SEC network.
Okay.
So those are the two. ACC, Pac-12, obviously substantial rights there. But at this point, the two biggest of the Power Five, I would say, for TV rights and media power would be the SEC and the Big Ten.
And does this affect football only? Are these colleges affects now?
Basketball.
Okay. Yeah.
And other stuff too. Okay. I mean, the second tier sports. Yeah. Hmm.
So why isn't there just like one league? Why do we have these conferences?
It's all about money. it's all about money, because what happens is, so whatever deal these conferences get. So for example, they signed this over $1 billion deal with Amazon and Fox, right? Then now every college gets a percentage of that deal a year. Just large money flowing into these universities, and I'm sure presidents and athletic directors and sports directors are getting bonuses and percentages off it. I mean, the money in college sports is absolutely insane.
Right. And so when you're in a conference, everybody in the conference plays each other. Is that part of it?
Yep. And this is, and in the Bloomberg article to discuss that, one of the reasons why USC and UCLA wanted to do this is because they want the majority of their games to be seen in like an Eastern time zone. So obviously you can't really do anything a lot about the away games, but now all the, I mean, I'm sorry, the home games, but all their away games now will be at 7 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock at night, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 1 o'clock in the end. Like they're going to be at premier television times and not at 11 o'clock at night on the East Coast.
Okay. UB is in the ACC, is that right?
No, UB is in the Mid-American Conference.
Okay.
They are a mid, they're a mid-major, so they're not a Power Five.
And there's 100 football teams in the NCAA Division I, is that correct?
A little, might be a little more than that now.
Okay.
But around that number.
So this Big Ten is like the number two conference. SEC is number one when it comes to star power.
I would say,
is like Notre Dame.
No. Notre Dame's an independent because of their deal with NBC Comcast. They get all the money to get by themselves.
So they're not in a conference.
No. So they can get all the media rights money.
Are they the biggest name though? Because I feel like Ohio State and there's probably like Florida.
SEC has Alabama. Mm. That's SEC has Alabama. They have Florida. You mentioned Florida. They have Auburn. They now just added you, Brandon. Texas and Oklahoma are now in the SEC.
What does JR think about this? Is JR on board?
I mean, he's going to see Oklahoma, Alabama once a year. I think that's probably a big deal.
Are they going to? Have they discussed bringing on Jim Ross to be a commentator for some of those games?
I think he's done. Like guest spots, at least for the radio side of things for Oklahoma, yeah. And they always, I've seen like watch Oklahoma games and they say, oh, Jim Ross is here. He hangs on the sidelines a lot, or he used to, for games. I know him and Bob Stoops were really close at one point, so before when Stoops was the coach.
Does he ever get any of the players' names wrong?
I don't know that. I can't tell you. But yeah, so this is huge. Pac-12. It's got to do something. This benefits a lot of the mid-major colleges that move into these big conferences because then they get more money of the pie. We talked about UB at Buffalo, where we're from. They're still in a mid-major, not a lot of money. I would hope that one day they can maybe join like the ACC, but who knows?
Mm-hmm. I'm a graduate of UB. You went to Buff State, though, correct?
Buffalo State, yeah. Division III. No money there.
So they're in a division. They're in Division III.
Well, yeah, so NCAA is broken up into Division I, Division II, and Division III, and that's based on size of universities, I think, and like, you know.
They have a football team. They have a football field that gets passed all the time.
I was the play-by-play guy from 2006 to 2009. Yeah.
D3 football commentator Chris Gullo is joining us here.
Yeah, I also did basketball and hockey.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Cool. Anyway. So it looks like even more competitive bidding, even more money for TV rights fees in this case. Is that my takeaway here?
Yes, I think these college sports deals are going to break records. Now, the Pac-12, as we talked on this show, is up soon too. But now what did they do? Because clearly they're going to have to make a move, losing both teams in the Los Angeles market.
Hmm. Okay. Moving on to more. This is a media podcast, not just a wrestling podcast. Gavin Bridge from Variety has some really insightful analysis that came out this past week on Variety. The headline here is Formula One deal indicates sports rights are being driven off a cliff. He's making an argument here that this isn't sustainable. The TV rights money that's being handed out to sports leagues. I'm not sure if I'm convinced, but I think this is some great research that he's done here, where he's got, we're showing here on the screen, some of these charts here showing the annual value of US TV and streaming sports rights and how it's grown over time from 2015 to about $15 billion. Now, in 2023, it's going to, by 2026, it'll nearly have doubled over the course of, what would that be? 11 years or so. And looking at the breakdown of who's getting how much of the pie here, NFL, of course, has the biggest piece of the pie in the sports rights universe with 44%, followed by college. So I guess that would, when these deals that are being, that we were just talking about for the Big Ten and SEC and things like that, that's football only.
Football and basketball.
And basketball are being dealt together.
Yes.
Okay. So I guess that's what's being referred to here in this call out, college, which is the second biggest, you know, single piece, followed by the NBA, followed by Major League Baseball, which is roughly tied with soccer combined, which would be things like what? Premier League, La Liga, MLS. Maybe there's other things. Motor racing, Formula One just got a big upgrade. Golf, pro wrestling and golf are basically even. So pro wrestling probably combines AEW with WWE, but WWE has by far the bigger piece of that. The Olympics and the NHL. And then we've got another category here. So that's sort of the ranking, the breakdown, not including tennis and things like that. And the estimated percentage increase over the course of 2015 to 2026, wrestling has the biggest upgrade with a 369% increase. I guess that's driven by the upgrade that, I don't know what the underlying data here is and the formulation is here that is driving this chart. But we do know that Raw and SmackDown combined by being dealt to Fox and NBC Universal got a 3.6x increase over the prior deal for their current deal. So that makes some sense that wrestling has this giant increase and apparently bigger than anybody else's. Perhaps wrestling was undervalued previously and WWE definitely got a disappointing deal in 2014. Largely related to the timing of the launch of the network. So there's that. Again, our baseline expectation for what WWE is going to be able to attract, perhaps 1.5x. That's probably what's baked into the stock price right now. Expecting probably much higher, probably higher for AEW, whether or not it's going to reach my, 3 to 5x estimate that we can do the math on to say is on par with what they're delivering in terms of ratings compared to what WWE's they're delivering in terms of ratings. That remains to be seen, and whether or not their incumbent rights holder, Warner Brothers Discovery, is going to bid aggressively while they're preaching cost discipline, while they've expressed some questioning of Warner Media investments, especially when it comes to scripted entertainment, some questioning of how much Warner Brothers Discovery really values AEW when you consider how little they were featured in the upfronts. Couple that with Tony Khan's, Tony Khan being very eager to tell the story about how excited Warner Brothers Discovery is to be working with them and how great those meetings have gone so far. So there's that. I believe that. So I guess I'm skeptical about whether or not. Do you believe this, Golo, that this, let's put something relevant on the screen here. This increase, this growth of sports rights fees, this is not sustainable. And eventually, we're talking about cord cutting happening here. And we have a slide for that. We can show on the screen how less and less people are watching or subscribing to cable, which is largely what's supporting this system. This is a bubble. This is a bubble that's going to burst, isn't it?
Absolutely not. And that because of streaming, there's always going to be a platform to watch these sports. And who knows what it's going to be in 20 to 30 years. We don't know. You know what I mean? But there's always going to be a platform. And sports has grown in popularity. Yeah, sure, there's been dips of certain specific leagues. But sports in general has grown in popularity over the last 30, 40, 50 years. And now with betting being legal in a lot of states, and it will continue to be legal in more states, you don't think that popularity is going to even get higher and those rights deals are going to drive no matter what platform they're on. This bubble is going to burst. Even if linear television ends in 5 years, then we're talking Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Peacock. They're all going to have the rights and paying a lot of money for it.
We have people, by the way, speculating in the chat that you must be a big bettor.
Because I'm not. I'm just very. I was a sports business guy before I got into the WrestleNomics world. I was a wrestling fan, but like, I liked sports media. I had a sports talk radio show in college called the Buffalo Blitz, and you know, so I'm a little experienced in sports.
So I would say that there is this problem that streaming right now is not profitable for most of these players. You know, Netflix is profitable, but Netflix doesn't even have any sports right now. But a lot of these platforms are not profitable on their own. Maybe they'll be profitable someday, and of course, that's the goal. They may not be as profitable, though, as cable TV is, and that could be a problem. But I think cable TV, too, especially with the people who have it and who have had it for a number of years, is going to be pretty inelastic in terms of how far you can raise the price. You know, P50 Plus, for as long as they're alive, I think they're going to be subscribing to some form of cable. And you can raise the price incrementally against them, and it takes a lot for them to cancel and to actually cut the cord. That might happen. But nonetheless, I think that as long as we have this disparity, which I'm trying to illustrate here, this is P1849, between the most viewed programs and the majority of the programs, there's a huge disparity between the most viewed programs still and all other programs. And what disproportionately makes up the most viewed programs? It's sports and live sports, including wrestling. As we showed earlier on the screen this past Monday with the John Cena return, that was the most viewed telecast in 1849 on all of television on Monday. And Raw is often the most viewed telecast on cable when it's not football season. NFL isn't on Monday Night Football on ESPN. Raw is usually the top show on Monday in the demo.
We've seen. Oh, go ahead. I was just going to say we've seen over the years with the world of television, the rise and fall of sitcoms, the rise and kind of fall of you know, non-scripted TV reality shows. You know what's never really fell? Sports and news, television news programs. Those are going to be always the golden standards.
Because they're happening on demand right now. Yeah. They're happening right now. If you're not watching it while it's happening, you're missing out on something. And that's just not the way that people want to consume scripted entertainment or even unscripted reality shows. People want to watch that on demand because it's not as important to watch it as it's actually, because it's not happening as you're watching it. But anyway, there remains a big disparity between the most watched programs and most everything else. And that's not, there's not attrition happening there. That's not deteriorating. What I've got on the screen here is the number one show on average throughout an entire year versus the number 10 show. And if anything, that disparity is widening. So the most popular programs are increasingly more popular than the 10th most popular program on a given day. Compare that to the number 20, it's not as consistent of a widening gap. But it's not a declining gap either between 2016 and 6 months into 2022. This is cable only, by the way. So this is only the Showbiz Cable Originals. I didn't try to jam broadcast in here. If we look at total viewership, it is not as wide of a gap, because total viewership includes P50 Plus, who are not as volatile, not changing over time. But still, do we have a decline here? I would say that's not a negative slope in terms of the gap between number 1 and number 10. And do we have a negative slope in terms of the difference between number 1 and number 20? Not really, although there is this big, big difference in 2016 that is not nearly as wide in the subsequent years. Nonetheless, what we don't see here, at least yet, is a trend that makes everybody more comparable. That what we don't have is an increasing parity between programs, especially the top programs. And as long as there is this disparity in viewership among the top programs compared to everything down, as I said, this is an exponential curve. That's exactly what we're looking at here on the screen. It's even more exponential if we look at the demo, which is what drives ad rates. This is an exponential curve. So it's not even just a straight linear-shaped curve. This is an exponential curve. So the most viewed programs are way more watched than the programs that are just a few ranks below. And as long as there is that disparity in viewership in the most watched programs, there's going to be a disparity in fees for these programs, which not all of these are sports, Some of them are things like award shows or big news events. But disproportionately, they are sports. And that does include wrestling. As WrestleNomics listeners who watch what are the most highly ranked programs of the week know, it's often Raw, it's often SmackDown, and Dynamite is often finishing among the top as well. I believe they were number one this week among cable originals, again, in the demo. So as long as you're in the top five or so, so this does not apply to NXT. Does not apply to Rampage, which is underperforming on Friday nights. As long as there is this, as long as you're hanging around the top five, and the better you do within the top five, the better for you. But as long as you're hanging around the top five, I think you're going to be able to justify strong TV rights fees, even if that's not on cable.
But see, to your point with Rampage and NXT, they're second tier programs, part of a larger package, and you see them with other sports deals. You know, we talk about college sports, like. Yeah, Alabama versus Auburn's going to do great ratings, but some lower level SEC games won't do as well. I think it's a similar thing. I think every sports package has those second tier things that you just have to throw in. And I think Rampage NXT is like it's part of a larger package.
And I guess some other questions that I would want to know the answer to, though, that make me skeptical that the TV rights bubble is eventually going to burst. There's going to be some sort of financial crisis here. Is that, you know, the bidders that are responsible for running up these values, which we can put on the screen here. There's multiple bidders. It's not as if there's one delusional bidder or two delusional bidders. There's Disney, Comcast, Viacom, CBS, Fox, Disney, including ESPN, and even Amazon, even Apple now getting involved. There are numerous bidders here, even before the likes of Amazon and Apple got involved. And yes, Amazon and Apple have tremendously deep pockets, and they can afford to make these loss leaders more than the others can. But if there's going to be a bubble burst here, I think we have to assume that they've all made the same collective miscalculation, which is possible, but it seems to me unlikely, that all of the leadership in all of these companies are all getting this wrong. And how much does reallocating investment away from the scripted content that's not holding the bundle together as much anymore, how much does the reallocation of not spending on that so much, and how much does that free up money that they're now able to spend towards bidding aggressively for these sports TV rights? Furthermore, has the revenue that sports content generates for distributors, either directly or arguably indirectly, because it's creating synergy for your network and perhaps driving more viewership to your network generally, has that increased to some extent over this timeline while the rights fees have increased? So even though the cost is going up, has the revenue maybe increased also? Again, I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's a worthy question. So anyway, I think that's all I have to say about that.
All right.
And I guess we can I have some other things here on these slides, but we can look at, you know, is VMVPD. What's a VMVPD?
That I don't know.
It is a, what is it, you know what it stands for? It stands for virtual. Ooh, what does MVPD stand for? I don't know if I know, but I know. So the MVPD is just a way of saying cable or satellite.
Okay.
Multi-channel video programming distributor, I think is what it stands for. The V in VMVPD, which is a small case, the virtual MVPDs, which include things like Sling and Hulu Live TV and FUBU. Everyone's favorite question. Do the ratings include the streaming on Sling and Hulu Live TV? What's the answer to that, Cole?
Yes,
they do. Anyway, is that offsetting the big attrition in cable and satellite? No, it's not. But it is positive, at least. It is growing in most of these quarters here, year over year. We've got, you know, mid to high to low single digits in growth most of these quarters, with the exception of Q3 2021, where it did go down 2.5%. But otherwise, there is some growth there. It doesn't look like it's going to offset the larger decline in cable and satellite, especially satellite. Satellite is declining worse than cable. Even though you hate your cable company, I don't know if you hate your cable company as much as you hate your DirecTV and Dish Network company, but other traditional, which includes satellite largely, is declining worse than cable generally. We're basing this, by the way, on a report that comes out quarterly from LGR Research, they, I believe, go through a lot of SEC filings and public reports and collect the subscriber counts for major MVPD providers. So this is not all of the U.S. cable and satellite traditional TV world, but it is most of it. And that's where we're at. Among that total, we're at 74 million subs. So it's probably a little higher than that. 74 million homes. Again, probably a little bit higher than that as of March 2022.
All right. We do have a couple of super chats as we wrap up the show here. NYCKNP, I can see linear and streaming deals negotiated separately, similar to the what the IPL did.
That's it. We have not discussed. Yeah, IPL just renewed its deal, right? I don't have those details on hand, but we should be talking about that too. That's a good point.
I mean, you discussed that Rampage could be on a streaming service. That could be a different deal for when that's done with AEW, like linear TV.
That's what makes the most sense to me.
Yeah,
because it's. I don't know if you were to deal it away from Warner Brothers Discovery. I don't know where it fits, but it could fit in streaming. Streaming needs content, and it's never going to be favored. It's never going to have a better time slot in the incumbent network unless you put it on a weaker network, and that's not worth it. So anyway, do you know what IPL is?
That is, hold on a second here. I have to look here. Is that, that's cricket, right?
Yes, you uncultured swine. Yes, it's cricket.
No, I figured it was cricket, but I didn't want to say it wrong. I had to confirm. I have a question for what I just brought up, the point, right? We talked about how like AEW could shop Rampage to a streaming service. Is WWE pigeonholed where anything they put on the streaming has to go to Peacock?
No. Why?
No.
Why would
they be? Okay. Like, so for example, they're like, you know what? NXT is just, Comcast doesn't want to carry NXT anymore. But instead of putting on Peacock, they got to deal with Apple TV. Hey, Apple TV is going to have NXT on Wednesday nights.
When that deal is up, I don't see why they couldn't.
Or Tuesday nights, yeah.
Okay. I would guess that's a two-year deal. This is just with gas. I mean, because the other deal, the previous deal was 2 years. Let's say this is a two-year deal that probably went into effect this past fall, so it would expire 2 years from September 2021. So that would be September 2023. I would think maybe they wanted it to align with the other deal, so it might expire September 2024. That would probably be best for them, so that they could put something together if they wanted to. But I see no reason why they couldn't sell NXT.
I wasn't sure if they could put it on a different streaming service, but that makes sense.
I unless there's something in the Peacock contract that says you can't make a deal with any streaming service other than us, in the US, which I doubt.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then we just want to thank Joseph Carino. Just gave us some money. Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you. IPL, by the way, according to Google, the third most searched for sport in all the world, sports league in all the world. More than the NBA, more than the English Premier League. Or I'm sorry, those two are more than IPL. IPL is above everybody. And look at this growth in IPL worldwide search over time, the last few years especially. I discovered that Google Trends, which I just ran my script last night because it was, you know, the night of the second. Every night of the second, a script runs on this computer. But even before that, earlier this week, I discovered that there's been some change in how this data is appearing. Hopefully this is a Google Trends problem and not a me problem. But we've got, if you look at these two charts side by side, we end up with like, what? NBA and Premier League tied, whereas this on the right is a slide from the WrestleNomics Pro Wrestling Industry Report 2021, where Premier League was decidedly above NBA. And I don't know if I'm including the current year, and maybe that's what's happening. Anyway, anything else to add here?
No, we got another super chat coming in from Justin Robinson. You should bring in Jesse more. I enjoy his takes. He's speaking of Jesse Collins. Well, yes, we love having Jesse on.
Yes. Thank you, Justin. You're not the only one that I've heard that from. Appreciate that. I'm sure we will. If Jesse will make time for us, we will have him on again soon in the future. So anything else? Those all the chats?
Yeah, we are caught up on all the chats. Yes.
Okay. thumbs up, like, subscribe, share. We appreciate everyone listening. It's the new month. Today's the 3rd, so this is a great time to sign up for the WrestleNomics Patreon at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. My TV ratings reports are coming out nearly every weekday for the U.S. telecasts for Raw, SmackDown, Dynamite, Rampage, New Japan, Impact, and others. Quarter hour reports are a part of that, too. You get access to the WrestleNomics viewership spreadsheet that's got over 2,000 rows of data in there, not to mention all the analysis. You get slides, these slides that you're looking at on YouTube, if you're looking at it on YouTube right now, for all of our podcasts. We've also been putting out these Who's a Draw and Company Popularity Update podcasts that also have slides that subscribers get exclusive access to. You also get access to the Pro Wrestling Industry Reports for each of the last 3 years, as well as occasional additional reporting, including things like the report that I put out this past week on AEW pay-per-view buys and the report on what Forbidden Door did on pay-per-view. Again, you can subscribe for just $5 a month. Join the hundreds of subscribers, including wrestlers and executives in the business, and subscribe at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. We're also looking for somebody to help us out with some basically basic graphic design. I don't need like original artworks, but some basic graphic design to create things like thumbnails, maybe to do things like video editing for help us create the excerpts of our podcast on YouTube and maybe even TikTok, fellow kids. So again, and this would be something that somebody would be paid for. If you have those skills, please reach out to me. What do you have going on, Chris Gull?
Another bunch of July is kind of a late month as far as ring announcing. So listen to, of course, when I'm on WrestleNomics here and rediscovering the indies. We've been a little bit delayed on our new episode due to my partner having a very, very busy week here in for Game Changer Wrestling. We're going to hopefully have a new episode for you next week. So it's been a very busy summer for himself and myself too, but mostly.
Yes. We thank Post Wrestling, as always, for being our podcast distribution partner. We're going to try something new here, Chris Gull. Do you want to read us out?
I could definitely read us out. So we want to give special thanks to WrestleNomics contributors Jason Opernseth, Chris Ely.
Opernseth.
Yeah, Opernseth. See, I know it was there, but like the er is not there. So yeah,
I've
Jason Opernseth.
I've got the phonetic pronunciation for you in the notes.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see that there. Which says Chris Ely, technical consultant Phil Chertok. Special thanks to John Pollock, Wade Ting, and Corey Gibson. Showbuzz Daily and WrestleTix. WrestleNomics was created by Chris Harrington, distributed in cooperation with Post Wrestling, and supported by listeners and viewers like you.
Yeah, thanks to the Sears Roebuck Foundation. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.